Today is June 24th, 2022, and the Supreme Court of the United States voted to overturn Roe v. Wade in a 5-4 decision. Justice Samuel Alito wrote the majority opinion, joined by Justices Thomas, Gorsuch, Kavanaugh, and Barrett. And in light of today's ruling by the Supreme Court, we would like to present to you an encore presentation of episode 140 of the Hank Unplugged podcast, which was a conversation between Hank Hanegraaff and Frederica Matthews Green on how to become a pro-life advocate.
And welcome to another edition of the Hank Unplugged podcast, a podcast that is committed to bringing the most interesting, informative, and inspirational people directly to your earbuds. And one of those inspirational, informative, interesting people is a person that I have interviewed on this podcast a number of times. Her name is Frederica Matthews Green, and she is... well, difficult for me to introduce because there's so many different ways I could do it. On the one hand, she's a mentor and a friend, and I would say a hero to my children, my family in general. But she's also someone who has made an indelible mark on our culture. She is an author, not only of books, but also of essays. She's written more than, this is a staggering number, 800 essays. She's written for such diverse publications as The Washington Post, The Smithsonian, and The Wall Street Journal. She's also been a regular commentator for NPR and a podcaster for Ancient Faith Radio. One of the interesting things about Frederica is that she once was a staunch feminist. If you go all the way back to the early 70s, she was a strong advocate for abortion. She believed that abortion was essential as an element of a woman's control over her own life. But she later came to view abortion as an act of violence against unborn children, but also one which hurts a mother. And so she has been a person who was involved in not only speaking about the horrors of abortion, but what happens to a woman when she has an abortion. One of the books that I really want to focus on in this podcast is a book titled Real Choices, Listening to Women Looking for Alternatives to Abortion. And at the very outset of this podcast, I want to point out that Frederica is lauded, or at least respected, not only by pro-lifers, but by pro-choicers as well. And I'll give you an example of that for those listening into this podcast. For Frederica writes that no one wants an abortion as she wants an ice cream cone or as she wants a Porsche. She wants an abortion as an animal caught in a trap wants to gnaw off its own leg. Now, the reason I bring up that particular quote is not because it's memorable, but because it was the quote of the week in Planned Parenthood's Public Affairs Action Letter. It was the quote of the month in the Pro-Choice Network newsletter. But it was also a quote that first appeared for a pro-life movement. So here you have both the pro-choice side and the pro-life side using a quote from Frederica Matthews Green. So she's highly respected. She's eminently quotable. She's a great friend to the Christian Research Institute, the Bible Answer Man broadcast, and the Hank Unplugged podcast. And I'm delighted, as always, to have you on this podcast, Frederica.
Hi, Hank. Thanks so much for having me again. I love hearing your voice, and talking to you is always so easy and enjoyable. So I very much appreciate your asking me on the show.
Well, you know, you have interviewed me a few times as well. I remember we were having some function at my house, and there were all kinds of people over there, and you had a tape recorder, and you were interviewing me with kids pulling at my legs and, you know.
Couple of dogs in and out.
Dogs in and out.
Oh,
that's right.
Boy, yeah. It was a lot of fun.
Well, I truly love and respect you. And I want to start out this podcast by asking you a simple question, which is, how did you become a pro-life advocate?
Oh, boy, that really is something. Yes, as you said, I was not a Christian in college. My religion was feminism. I had a bumper sticker on my car that said, "Don't labor under a misconception, legalize abortion." So I was very blasé about it. And I, you know, assisted my friends and supported them when they had abortions. What changed my mind, I was home on break, over Christmas break, and I picked up a magazine, my father's copy of Esquire magazine. This was January 1976. And there was a little short article, just two pages, by a doctor. He didn't do abortions, but he was curious about them. And he asked his friend, he said, "Next time you do one, I'd like to just observe." So he just described, and the title of the piece was, "What I Saw at the Abortion." And what he saw in this almost late-term abortion was the woman lying back on the table, and his friend, the doctor, took a syringe and stuck it right into her abdomen, pushing through the walls of the abdomen into the uterus and injecting the uterus with a hormone solution, prostaglandin. And he left the needle standing there, and the doctor writing it said, "I see something I didn't expect. I see that the syringe is wobbling back and forth."
Mm.
And he realized that it was the death throes of the unborn child. This was published in Esquire magazine. And so he said, "You know, what I saw there, you can tell me all kinds of things about abortion, but nothing is able to answer the truth of what I saw that day." And for me, that really hit me because, you know, as a hippie feminist, I was anti-war, anti-death penalty, anti-this, anti-that. We can have a society with no violence. I was even a vegetarian at that time. And in all of these things, at the very center of it was my feminism. At the center of the feminism was the need to be able to have an abortion. And I saw in a flash that it was an act of violence, that I was opposed to violence everywhere else in my convictions. And I had this huge anomaly, this huge reversal at the very center of what I believed. So, Hank, that, like, changed my mind in an instant. I was just so repelled by that thought. But I didn't, I didn't know what to do about it. I was so liberal. I didn't like conservatives. You know, I didn't want to have pro-life friends. And so I just kind of kept this to myself until I heard of an organization called Feminists for Life. And I ended up becoming a vice president in Feminists for Life and speaking on college campuses all over the country, trying to present a secular case for how abortion actually hurts women.
Hmm.
So that was how I got into it.
Yeah, so it's not only violence against the unborn child, but it's violence against a woman. And that's one of the things that you emphasize over and over again in your book, Real Choices.
Yes, yes. We tend to gloss over that, but this is a horribly invasive procedure. It's worse than a natural miscarriage because in a natural miscarriage, at least the whole body is kind of in on the process and the hormones are adjusting. Everything's adjusting to that sad state. But with this chemical or mechanical invasion of the uterus, turning everything upside down, bringing death into the house of life, you know, introducing death into the center of a woman's being. It's so unnatural, and it's such a violation of her bodily integrity. It's impossible for a rational person to think this is actually a feminist goal.
How do you overcome abortion fatigue? One of the things that I was considering as I was talking to David and various other people about doing this podcast is that people hear about abortion over and over again, and then they end up sort of tuning it out. I just don't want to deal with this. I don't want this on my horizon. I don't want to think about this.
Wow, that's really true. And, you know, I was just reading this afternoon something about if you say climate change, that's one thing, but if you keep saying climate emergency or climate crisis, people just get numb to it, and they don't hear it anymore. So it actually backfires to use extreme language. That's a problem that pro-lifers have faced from the beginning, because there's no way that this is not an extreme and horrifying thing to do, that we have committed 62 million abortions in America since Roe v. Wade. It's like the only thing you can do with it is to try to numb your mind so you think about something else, just as you were saying. It's so horrifying that if it turns out it really is a baby, pro-choice people can't even admit that to themselves. It's just so overwhelming.
How did you feel about Roe v. Wade in the 70s?
Yeah, back in the early days, as a matter of fact, I was a volunteer for a feminist magazine, a tabloid called Off Our Backs. Off Our Backs. And I actually had a movie review published in the issue that came out immediately after Roe v. Wade. And the editorial said, Roe v. Wade doesn't go far enough. It says that you have to have a medical reason for an abortion in the last trimester. And that shouldn't be a restriction. Women should be able to have abortions whenever they want them. So that's where I was. I was so extreme on this. Now, the thing that's happened, though, is sonograms. Because for me, you know, people told me it was a blob of tissue, and I believed that. But everybody's seen a sonogram now. Everybody knows that it is a baby. There's really no denying that. It's kind of a schizoid thing that we pretend we don't know that, and we call it a fetus if the woman's walking in an abortion clinic. Otherwise, we call it a baby. Everybody knows there's something wrong there.
I want to tell a story. I don't know if I've ever told you this story, Frederica, but this happened in my studio. I was talking about the tapestry of life and how the tapestry of life begins with essentially a single thread. And then through a process of incredible precision, a microscopic egg in one human being is fertilized by a sperm cell from another. And that process not only marks the beginning of a new life, but it also marks the genetic future of that life. And I was explaining how in time that fertilized egg divides into the 30 trillion cells that make up the human body, including 12 billion brain cells that form over 120 trillion synapses or connections. I was talking about that on air, and in the context of speaking about that, someone called me up and asked me about when life begins, and I was talking about how life begins at conception and that it's not only a physical reality, but it's a metaphysical reality as well. So I was talking about all of that in the Bible Answer Man broadcast. At any rate, a couple heard me talking about this, and that couple decided as a result of the communication on the show that day that they were going to adopt a frozen embryo. And so the frozen embryo arrived via FedEx and was implanted in this lady's uterus and was brought to full term. And then I had the privilege of meeting the little girl that was born. I remember holding her in my arms. I went to their home and held her in my arms. And it was very interesting because the mother said, you know, Elise doesn't allow men to hold her, but she's just cuddled up in your arms. And from that time on, I've had a connection with Elise, and she has come into the studio. And one day she came into the studio, was listening to me do the broadcast, and someone asked the question about frozen snowflakes or whether or not we ought to adopt a frozen snowflake. And she just sent me a picture just a little while ago. I have it in my office. She's 16 years old now, drop dead gorgeous. And Chris and Eric are the proud parents of this wonderful girl, Elise.
Wow. And like you say, it's a metaphysical connection too. That God used you at that moment, and he had prepared the hearts of this couple to receive that arrow, that convicting arrow, and the inspiration to even conceive. And that's a pun, I guess, to conceive of doing such a thing. And then you'll be bound together somehow in the eyes of God forever because of that moment when you planted the seed in their hearts and they brought it to fruit. A wonderful thing.
Yeah, and I suppose the reason I wanted to share that story in this context is so many people think that, well, when does an abortion really take place? Is it the first trimester, the second trimester, the third trimester? People say, is this a clump of cells at one point? Is it a creature? Is it a fish or a frog? And then the second trimester becomes a person. So there are all these questions that are bandied about in this regard. And when you think about how a fertilized human egg, a sperm cell in one human being fertilizes an egg in another human being, and out of that you have a new human being. And when you see that that fertilized human egg, the size of a pinhead, can be frozen and then a few years later can be implanted in the uterine wall of a woman, and now there's this beautiful 16-year-old, I mean, it immediately lets you know that from the very moment, this is not just a simple cell or a cluster of cells. This is an intricate, majestic masterpiece of God.
A masterpiece, yes, yes, the creation of God. And there, in that form of that tiny fertilized egg, just waiting, it's like, as others have said, it's like you took the plans, an architect plans for your house, and put it on the ground, and a house built itself. Mm. You know, it's that tiny little egg that has everything inside of it when it's fertilized.
Mm.
I find when I argue with people about this, they keep saying it's not a baby. What they mean is it's not a person. They know it's something, but they don't want it to have the rights that a person would have under the U.S. government, under the Constitution. And so I always make three points. That it is human. It is composed of entirely human cells. As you say, it's not a raccoon, it's not a watermelon, it's a human. It is alive, it is living, it is growing. The cells are combining and separating and multiplying over and over and over and over again until it creates, you know, and eventually a beautiful 16-year-old girl. But the most important point is the third one, which is that it is unique, that you can take a cell from the mother, a cell from the father, and this one little cell, the egg with the sperm dissolved in it, and if you examine them, you would find three different DNAs. There are three different people here. It's not just a part of the mother's body. The mother is sheltering it, but it is a different human being. And I find they have no comeback for that. As you've probably found, they really don't want to talk about abortion at all. They will change the subject. They will avoid it if they keep trying to say, you know, it's not a person, and you show them these three points. They'll just change the subject again. Mostly, they like to attack pro-life people and just make it an ad hominem attack, you know, just, oh, you hate women, and you're opposed to sex and opposed to this and that. Because I can't really defend abortion. There's no way to defend it. So they change the subject and attack the messenger.
Yeah, and one of the things that you do so beautifully in your book, Real Choices, listening to women looking for alternatives to abortion, I think one of the great parts of this book is it's not just clinical. You listen to real women. You were involved in a project over a protracted period of time where you're listening to women in different parts of the country and their stories are being told. So you're getting it from the mouths of women who have gone through abortions. And I want you to talk about that, because one of the things you say is that you oppose abortion because it violates women's bodies even more deeply than rape does.
Yes.
And this is a hideous violation, since it brings grisly death into the very house of life. That's a stunning statement in and of itself.
Yes, yeah. Yes, I began the Real Choices Project. My immediate practical goal was I wanted to help pregnancy care centers meet the needs of pregnant women. And I thought, well, I'll ask them, what are your needs? Because we could go on piling up more and more maternity clothes, but maybe that's not what they need. You know what I mean? I was looking to pin exactly what it was pregnancy centers should focus on. And I had three approaches I wanted to take. One, I sent a survey to all the pregnancy centers in America and got back their idea of what they thought they needed and the needs they saw the women having. I wanted to do the same thing with abortion clinics, because it would be the same information. You know, I was curious about whether people who go into abortion clinics give the same reasons for their decision as those who end up having giving life through the help of a pregnancy center. But I couldn't get any pro-choicers to work with me. The third, though, and I think the one of lasting importance, is I went around the country, and in seven different cities, I sat down with a group of women who had had abortions, and some of them were pro-life, some were still pro-choice, but they'd all had an abortion. And I asked them, what led up to your decision? What caused you to think that this was the best course you could take? Because I thought then, you know, if they're saying, oh, I needed maternity clothes, then we'd get more maternity clothes. I just wanted to know what they thought the most important need was. Well, Hank, the weird thing is that as I listened to them, you know, a number of them said, I didn't need anything material. I had enough money. I had resources. Or I knew that there was a pregnancy center that would give me everything I need. Often they said it really wasn't anything like that. What I needed was a friend who would stand by me because I was so alone. Over and over, 88% of the time, the women who had had abortions, the reason they did it was for the sake of somebody else, somebody who was pressuring her to have the abortion, maybe. Most of the time it was the boyfriend or the father of the child. Twice women told me, I was lying on the abortion table and praying that one said my husband, another said my boyfriend, would burst in the door and say, stop, I changed my mind. So this was not the woman's choice. But in order to hold on to the relationship, or because the father of the child is just berating her so much, she ends up going through with the abortion. Some of the time, a smaller percentage, it was somebody else in her family. Perhaps she and the boyfriend said, we'd love to get married, and her parents said, no, you're too young. You know, it was the parents that insisted on the abortion. In a couple of very touching cases, it was my mother was a single mom, and she was sick, and she was working two jobs, and I just couldn't add this extra stress to her life. There were a couple of stories along those lines. But in most of the cases, 88% of the time, there was no practical or material need that pregnancy centers could offer that would have made any difference. But they kept saying, if one person had stood by me, and of course that is what pregnancy centers do. If they have nothing else, they can open the doors and turn on the lights and make the coffee. And if a woman comes in, they can embrace her, they can talk to her, they can be that friend that will help her get through some of the hardest months of her whole life. That's what pregnancy centers exist for, to do that.
To read through those stories, I think, in a book on abortion is a real breakthrough. And there are so many aha moments that I had as I read through your book, one of them being that pro-life advocates see their chief role as defending the unborn baby. And then you say, by default, therefore, the woman becomes the enemy. I'd like you to cash that out for people.
Yes, yes, that's such a difficult thing and such a trap for pro-life rhetoric, I think. If you ask pro-life, or what I found when I was asking pro-life leaders a while back, if you ask them, why do you do this, they almost always say, because of the baby. That's the main motivator. Even if their entire work for the cause has to do with helping pregnant women. It's, ironically, it's the reverse of you're talking the talk but not walking the walk. They were doing an excellent job walking the walk, but if you put a microphone in front of them, they would always say abortion kills babies. And it's true that is the most galvanizing thing about it. I think if it wasn't causing the death of babies, that perhaps Christians and pro-lifers wouldn't have been as involved or as persistent. But the urgency of it actually being death is what continues to drive us. The point I was making is that this automatically, by default, if pro-lifers are championing the baby, then it immediately looks like people automatically think that, well, where's the other side? Who cares about the mother? And that would be the pro-choicers who are claiming that they're on the side of the mother and we're trying to oppress her. And pro-lifers have tried to rebalance this by saying, love them both. I saw a beautiful drawing of a pregnant woman and it said, coexist over the front. You know, you can coexist. You're designed to coexist. And we have tried to make a more holistic approach to the question. But if we get caught in that trap where it's as if we're fighting for the baby, but the pro-choicers are fighting for the mother, it backfires on us because the women are the ones who vote. The babies don't get to vote. They don't have any public voice. And they can take photos of the women looking sad, you know, and publish that everywhere. And we can't really combat that. So it's very important that pro-lifers continue to say, love them both. They are an organic unity, and that we're defending both of them.
How do you balance this in terms of the debate between the pro-choice side and the pro-life side so that the debate is actually a debate that advances the issue as opposed to simply galvanizing people in their own positions?
Yes, it's difficult to do that. And one of the ways I approached it back in the 90s was that I was instrumental in setting up groups where pro-life and pro-choice could come together and talk to each other. We called it common ground. It wasn't a goal that we would try to arrive at a position we both agreed with. That wasn't going to be possible. Instead, we made it clear that we're not here to persuade anybody or change any minds. We just want to understand. I used to say the common ground movement is about clearing away the misunderstandings so we can end up in sincere disagreement. We were still going to disagree at the end of the day. I learned a lot from that experience. We had 12 cities where there were these little groups where pro-life leaders and pro-choice leaders would meet and just sit and talk to each other. One of the things we did was divide up into little groups of four, two of each side, and each person tell the story of why they took the position they did. Why did you come to this position? And then the person from the other side would summarize it and state the other person's position in terms that were not insulting, in terms that they recognized as accurate. Now, if you can imagine being a pro-life person in that position, it's a wonderful feeling of relief to have a committed pro-choice person say back to me exactly, accurately, and respectfully what I believe. I found it very useful, too, as a pro-life person, because I wanted to understand what motivated pro-choicers. You know, that's even just a kind of research on your opposition you want to do. Figure out what is motivating them and if there are ways to resolve their discomfort and hopefully coax them over to the pro-life side. So it was helpful to do that, and I feel like I learned a lot. One of the things I particularly noted was that the pro-choicers were all over the place in terms of what they believed. You know, some of them would say, but I don't think there should be abortion after 12 weeks, or I don't think it ought to be legal except in these exceptional circumstances. They didn't agree with each other about how abortion should be legal or illegal. And yet the pro-lifers were absolutely of one mind. I remember a pro-choicer saying to me, any thinking person has to be deeply ambivalent about abortion. And I thought, I'm not ambivalent. I don't have any ambivalence about this issue. I feel like there's a very clear moral and spiritual danger here. And I'm not wondering how I stand in relation to that. So that was encouraging in a way, to think that pro-choicers are actually not as united as we might think, and that they are, as my friend said, deeply ambivalent. There's an ambivalence there that I think things are going to turn around. Here we are almost 50 years since Roe v. Wade, but there's encouragement in the polls. There's encouragement here and there. I think eventually this country's going to turn around on the issue.
Elaborate on that. That's a stunning statement.
Yes, yes. One of the things, I was reading a wonderful article by Marvin Olasky in World Magazine. The viewpoint split now, according to Gallup, is 46% call themselves pro-choice, 49% call themselves pro-life. Now, that puts pro-life only a few points ahead of pro-choice. The thing about it is, though, is that the label, you know, pro-choice is the cool label. That's the one that's socially approved, so that's the one people want to use. And to think that a majority will actually call themselves pro-life when pro-lifers are despised, when we are lied about, when we are castigated and hated everywhere, that people still feel so strongly about it that they will take that label, I think is really a big thing. And another statistic I saw here, I hadn't heard about this, you know, at the race for the governor of Virginia, I'm reading from the Washington Examiner, Terry McAuliffe, who lost, the Democrat who actually lost, spent millions telling voters that his opponent would sign a restrictive abortion law like the one in Texas. Exit polling showed that when they asked voters, what was your main reason for your choice? Those who said their main reason was the abortion issue went for the Republican candidate by 20 points. So way ahead of those who would vote on a pro-choice basis was people voting on a pro-life basis. We just don't hear much about this because it doesn't fit the preferred narrative. I'm sure you've touched on that many times. That it's going to be a big surprise to the media when the pro-life movement starts to kind of stretch its muscles and become more evident, because they don't think it's possible. It doesn't fit the way that they look at life. But I think that it is going to turn around in time. Just the advent of sonograms made a huge difference in creating that ambivalence about it. And people don't feel united in this cause. I'm surprised so many will even take the label pro-life upon themselves. But they're not satisfied with what's happening. And many people said that they thought there should be no abortions after 12 weeks. That, in fact, is the law in much of the world. In France, it's no abortions after 12 weeks. And here in the Dobbs case before the Supreme Court, it's 15 weeks, and people are still being, you know, distressed about that and doing all the beating of the breasts. But it's something people prefer. They want to see it more restricted than it is.
You know, what's really interesting is that the United States has about the most liberal policy with respect to abortion. Maybe there are some countries more liberal, like Canada, but it is really open in the United States compared to, as you just mentioned, other countries like France or even the Netherlands, where I was born.
Yes, that's right. It's, as we think of the nations of Europe leading the world in liberalism, it's totally not the case when it comes to abortion. Three quarters of the nations in the world, including most of Western Europe, have bans against abortion after 12 weeks. And so America's way outside the field there compared to other countries, where that belief, that acknowledgement that it actually is a human life, people are making room for that. But in America, it has to be this juggernaut that rolls over everybody. And in some states, as in New York, they want to make it legal up through 9 months, right up to the point of birth.
I probably should have done this at the very beginning of this podcast, but I think it's important to give people a perspective, Frederica, on just how significant, how macro this issue is. When you look at the foundation of civilization, life is that foundation. On that foundation, there are pillars like marriage, church, government, and so on. But the foundation is life. And I think we need to impress upon people just how significant this is. I'm looking at a quote from your book where you say, "Surely any society that makes mother and child enemies is slowly committing suicide." And then you say, "When we institutionalize the violent ripping of a child from her mother's womb, we violate something disturbingly close to the heart of the human story. In the land where women kill their unborn children, every lesser love grows frail." So you've really encapsulated the significance of this issue. And I want to really focus on that for a few moments, because I think so many people, again, as we said earlier on, have abortion fatigue. They don't want to talk about it. And you're saying, let's talk about it. It's a significant issue. And oh, by the way, we may be winning this war.
Yes, yes. So there is hope. And I think we will win this war for exactly the reason that that little excerpt that you quoted there, because this is the heart of the human story, is the life beginning in the woman's womb, just one cell, two cells, four, six, eight. That is where all humanity comes from. As you were saying, other institutions like marriage and the family and the legal system, all that stands on a foundation of human beings actually existing and actually making it all the way to birth intact. That has to be the very first thing. And that the love between a mother and her unborn child is so iconic that if that's distorted and turned into enmity or an imaginary possibility that the two of them are fighting each other and only one can survive, that's so distorted and so dark. It cannot be something that remains forever. It has to be challenged. What could be more ugly than that? I sometimes use the example of if there was a zoo and the female mammals started trying to abort their pregnancies, if they were trying to find the little grasses and leaves that would make them go into contractions and expel the unborn baby, or if they were like trying to hurt themselves by falling on rocks or something, the zookeeper would not say, "Well, I'll make it easier for them to abort their unborn species, whichever species it is." He would know immediately. There's something terribly wrong in the environment that my animals are living in. I have to identify what that was and correct it. So the emphasis from the pro-choice side that it is the woman, her body, her life, her choice, all of those first-person singulars that see it just as her all alone, that indicates the problem, which is that a culture can't exist unless we bond with each other and rely on each other. It begins with a bond between the mother and the child. But we have created such an atomized culture where it's every man for himself, every woman for herself, every individual. As our culture just falls to pieces and there is no more trust, that's it's destructive of on a grander scale than when we usually think about abortion just applying to the baby.
I want to talk about two things. You just mentioned a slogan. Talk about slogans, good and bad. You know, let's say the slogan, "It's a baby," or "Let the woman decide." But I also want to talk about paradoxes, if you would. You have pointed out that even though a majority call abortion murder, it's the kind of murder that somehow or other we want to keep legal.
I know. I know. And I was thinking just the other day how telling it is that pro-choicers accuse pro-lifers of being opposed to sex, as if, almost as if they're granting that if I didn't have abortion, I couldn't be free to have sex without commitment as much as I want to, as if it really is about sex for them. And that's just part of the atomizing of our culture, that people want to be free to have sex with other people with no commitment to each other. And I've been thinking lately about how strange the whole gender thing is, because now it's, you know, it used to be sex required at least two people, right? And now it's all these people all by themselves standing up as separate individuals and saying, this is my sexuality. They have even managed to make sex no longer something about uniting with another person. It's just the bumper sticker on your car. So this disintegration of our culture, in some ways, that's the thing that worries me the most, this extreme individualism where you renounce any commitment to anyone else or any responsibility for anyone else. We're all just little satellites whirring and whizzing around the world and occasionally bumping into each other. That is a profoundly disturbing thing to me, and I think it will have very high costs as the years go by.
What do you think America would look like without abortion?
If there wasn't legal abortion, I think that it would compel those who should be responsible in an unplanned pregnancy to resume some of that responsibility. That would include not only the father of the child, but her own parents, her friends, her boss having to be more flexible in her case, and everybody would have to evolve some response to it. And I think that's one of the reasons that people like having abortion legal, is that it's the easiest solution to the problem for everybody else in her life. You know, it's like nobody has to, you know, change the schedule of who comes in on Tuesday. The boyfriend doesn't have to change anything. Her parents don't have to be embarrassed. Nobody has to change anything except inside the body of the woman. And in a way, that's very anti-feminist to, you know, here's a social problem. Well, we'll go inside the woman's body and fix it there and not inconvenience anyone else. Our extreme atomization as a culture has been aided and abetted by legal abortion. And if it were to go, I think the feminists would begin to call for the support that they should have from the larger community. I've said that abortion is like a funnel because it resolves all the questions at once. You know, just wipes the slate clean. They used to accuse us of wanting to turn back the clock, but abortion does almost literally turn back the clock, and like a time machine, it puts her in the condition she was before she got pregnant. Nobody has to grieve over that except her, privately, all alone. This extreme atomization of our culture and the washing our hands of responsibility for each other, it's bearing lots of bad fruit in lots of ways. If abortion was illegal, it would no longer be possible to do that. We would have to acknowledge the needs of pregnant women and adjust. Yeah, everybody adjust just a little bit all around so that this is possible for her, that the burden is not on her alone to prepare for this new coming child.
You sort of touched on this already, but what about someone who's a skeptic who says that if America made abortion illegal, then this would benefit the rich because the rich could go somewhere else in the world. And then the poor would be harmed because they don't have anywhere else to go.
That is just, isn't that just the stupidest argument? Yes, you're right. I certainly do hear that. And it is entirely parallel to if you make murder illegal, then rich women will still be able to hire assassins to get rid of their husbands. Poor women can't hire assassins. They will just have to kill their husbands by some other way that may not work. They might get injured in the process of killing their husband. What a terrible thing. So we have to keep murder legal. It's a non-moral and even a non-logical way of approaching the problem.
Yeah, the illustration just I mean, that's the answer. Illustrations like that are powerful. I mean, to be able to take the arguments and then break them down by way of illustration, you really don't have to say much because it just makes it, as you said, self-evidently absurd or stupid.
I've been thinking about that a lot lately, Hank, actually, about how everything is easier to understand if we use illustrations. And that arguing merely rationally, arguing about ideas or arguing about philosophy, that doesn't have a lot of sticking power. It tends to get shed before too long. But if you can put an image in someone's mind, it sticks there forever. You're a writer and communicator, and so am I. And I'm sure you, like me, I have been surprised at the things I've written that became sticky, so to say, and keep showing up and being repeated in other contexts. Like the thing you started out with, my analogy of a woman wants an abortion like an animal caught in a trap wants to gnaw off its own leg. I didn't anticipate that that would be something that was quoted and quoted here, there, and everywhere, and even in pro-choice publications.
I was thinking, as you were speaking, about Whoopi Goldberg, who employed the abortion argument in suggesting that abortion rights advocates would take pro-lifers more seriously if they were willing to adopt babies who are slated for abortion. And I think, just in the same way that you used an illustration, you can use an illustration in this particular case by saying that the fallacy becomes obvious when it's put in different words. So if, for example, you won't adopt my babies, don't tell me I can't kill them.
Yes, that's right. That's right. And you know this too, although not everyone does, but the demand for babies is huge. Everybody wants to adopt babies. There are tens of thousands of couples waiting and hoping that they can adopt a baby. Any color, any condition, babies born with spina bifida, babies that are certainly going to die within a year, the list is very, very long. Babies with Down syndrome, as charming and sweet as they are, you know, there are long lists of people who would love to adopt a baby with Down syndrome, but babies hardly ever become available for adoption. It's very rare. You know, this was one of the funny things I learned in the Common Ground discussions, was that both pro-lifers and pro-choicers felt that it would be a good thing if women considered adoption. If they would give their child for adoption, the child could go to a family that maybe has been waiting years in hopes of eventually bringing a child to their home. And the woman could go ahead and follow the plan of her own life and really do something heroic in that. Both pro-life and pro-choice agreed on that, and the pregnant woman almost always disagrees. It is the last choice. People who do counseling in pregnancy care centers say, if you mention adoption to the mother, to the pregnant woman, it looks to her like the worst choice, because if she has the abortion, mentally it's like the child never existed and she's gotten rid of it. If she raises the child, she can love it and care for it. If she gives the child for adoption, though, it looks to her like abandonment. And perhaps she herself has some scars from being abandoned. And she worries that the child may not be treated right. It's a weird thing because it's like her nascent attachment to the child and wanting it to have a good life. It's like she can't fight that completely. That's right there. It's making her concerned about her child's life if it was adopted. But then she makes this irrational decision that, well, I'll just kill it instead of letting it go to an adoptive family. So of all the things that are wrong with the argument that, you know, if only pro-lifers would adopt these babies, they have no idea of how many couples are hoping to adopt a baby, and they're just not available.
Yeah, I want to get back to that subject in a bit, but perhaps you can, in the meantime, talk about contraception. You make a point that instead of the expected reduction in teenage pregnancies, greater adolescent involvement in family planning programs was associated with significantly higher teenage pregnancy rates.
Yes, and you're talking about my book, Real Choices, which I must confess, was published in 1994. So a lot of the statistics, a lot of that kind of analytical part of the book would need to be updated. But this was definitely true, that all the emphasis in the schools from middle school upward on when you have sex, you need to do this. You need to use contraceptives. You need to be sure you're safe and you're protected against disease and one thing after another. And all this emphasis is impressing on these young people that they're supposed to have sex. It's like, well, we know you're going to do it, so here we are. So the little girl that doesn't want to do it feels like the whole world is against her. And she should listen to her body, because apparently she's supposed to want to do it. And then she should go ahead and do it. And, you know, a lot of times it doesn't end well for these girls, but they're launched on a lifetime habit of unwed sex and sex without commitment. And it's been a disaster for women. There's huge amounts of unhappiness among women because of exactly this assumption. But the emphasis on contraception is, in a way, what starts them out.
Unpack the cliché. We're talking about slogans and paradoxes, but clichés as well. One that you've mentioned is that girls give sex in order to get love and that boys give love in order to get sex.
Yes, that's an old saying, and I think it does have a lot of truth to it, that girls are willing to have sex with boys if only the boys will love them. And then they're heartbroken when it turns out what was attracting the boy was the craving to have sex. It's an extremely strong craving in the teenage years and almost overwhelming to the boys. And they're not really that interested in the girl, you know, half an hour after they have sex with her. So it's two desires conflicting with each other. And making sex very cheap, very easy to get. You don't have to economize and save up. It's right there. Deflating the value of sex, making it easy, making it free, free sex, free love, works against the women because now the women don't have as much bargaining power. Now it's assumed that they will just give away sex continuously, no matter how the boys treat them. So it's one more of the things that have backfired on feminism and actually rendered the situation for women and girls worse than it was before.
Wow. What category of women, and this is a real setup question, I mean, there's an obvious answer to it, what category of women have the highest levels of sexual satisfaction? Or maybe it's not so obvious, I don't know.
I think it is so, and I think that's been found over and over through the decades. It's that the women who are most sexually satisfied, who respond, you know, check that top box when they're responding to a survey about it, are women who are married. And in fact, married people just have a lot more sex than unmarried people do. And so it's something to do with that sense that a married woman has of being safe and being cared for. It's a weird kind of journey or passage that I thought about when I was writing Real Choices, which is that the girl's, the woman's drive is all about safety and protection because she's going to conceive and she will give birth. And so she wants a safe environment and a good, steady guy. And she knows that he's going to stick with her if he's wildly in love with her. So his attitude of loving her, his willingness to give an expensive engagement ring, expensive as far as he's concerned, all of this evidence is reassuring to her because she's looking for safety. And boys, as we know, are looking for danger. They want to do all kinds of crazy things. And hopping from one girl to the next also comes very easily to them. So the attraction, bringing the two together, it has a different motivation on each side. And the thing is that eventually men and boys find that they are lonely. You know, I found, Hank, a few years ago I noticed when I was giving a talk, if I mentioned the word loneliness, it was like the audience would freeze. I was very surprised at this. The epidemic of loneliness is so heartbreaking today, partly because of the triumph of free love. You don't have that motivation of, and then we'll be able to have sex. Instead, it's been so cheapened and so, quote, free, and people have been so disconnected from each other. that it has left a lot of people very lonely. They don't really know how to go about selecting a spouse or how to continue a marriage once they're in one. They have maybe never seen a good marriage. They may have never seen one. So we're depriving these people and setting up a generation for perpetual loneliness, and we're not teaching them how they could reverse that. But all the emphasis in our culture on consumerism and on sexual images surrounding us are designed to keep people dizzy and craving and uncertain and thinking of themselves as little atoms bouncing around inside a molecule with no real connection to anyone else.
Let me ask you a very shallow question. And that shallow question is, should we want to wake up next to someone sexy, or is it better to want to wake up next to someone who is kind, particularly when you think about this question from the perspective of time?
That's so true. And I thank you for the setup, because you're quoting me.
I am.
Our craving to really bond with another person, to trust another person, to really merge our lives is so deep. And that's not what the culture throws at us or encourages us to do. We're always encouraged just to keep having a good time. But the line is that what we want most of all is not to wake up next to somebody sexy tomorrow morning, but to wake up next to somebody kind 50 years from tomorrow morning. We want to have those deep-rooted relationships that you can go through all the ups and downs of life together with someone you really love. That's what we're made for. Humans, it seems, are one of the few mammals that bond for life, if they can find a partner for life. Not many others do. Many of them are, you know, just with a different partner every year. But it seems that we do bond for life, and I've puzzled over why that is. Because if it's the deer that's going through your backyard and chewing up your landscaping, the male and the female deer meet and part. We remember from Bambi, and the mother raises the fawn, and Bambi finally has a glimpse of his father at some point. So that's very different lines. Why is it that humans don't do that? Why do human couples stay together after they're past the age of bearing children? And I think it has to do with that deep hunger to merge with another person in many ways other than sexually, to truly become one with them. I know you've had a beautiful marriage, and so have I, and we both know how rare that is these days. I'm going to be 50 years married in 2024, and what a wonderful time, and especially because we were both atheists and hippies. And on our first date, my husband said, "I'm such a feminist that if I ever get married, I want to hyphenate my wife's name to my name." And he did. So he's Father Gregory Matthews Green, just like he was the Matthews, I was the Green. We were just so committed to all of that. And yet our Lord led both of us to him and seized our hearts and made us fall in love with the Lord even more than we love each other.
Mm.
And what a wonderful basis, what a wonderful foundation that has been for our marriage.
You know, that's something you ought to talk about as well in this context. How significant is the sacrament of marriage? My son David got married in our backyard. And then when he became Orthodox, he realized the significance of sacrament, and he got remarried in the church.
Oh. Good. I'm so glad. Yes, the Orthodox sacrament of marriage is, of course, extremely ancient. And what's different about it compared to Western forms of marriage is that the husband and wife really don't say anything. They actually don't take vows. It is rather that they appear, they have this sacramental service. It's about 45 minutes long. And it is the priest, the sacramental presence of the priest. It is the ancient church that says to them, "Now you are married." They walk around the table with crowns on their heads, and they go around it three times, and then they are a married couple. So it doesn't have to do with their own ability to vow something or other, because we're weak. But the church has pronounced that now you are married. It's a beautiful service.
Mm. It is a beautiful service. I get so emotional when I see the sacrament of marriage unfold in the context of the church, which is the epicenter of the universe. I want you to talk as well, Frederick, about the problems of single parenting. You know, how necessary it is for men and women to complement one another in the raising of a child. So when you have gender undifferentiated parenting, you have a problem right at the outset.
Yes, yes. And I think that's so obvious that you have to be, you know, extremely committed to being one-sided to think that it's not. It's been a strange thing because it's so obvious that being a single mother is not possible in many ways. It's simply too stressful and that it doesn't serve the child well. It's so much better if both parents are there in the home. And you're not allowed to say that because people immediately say, why are you judging single mothers? Why don't we support them? Why don't we say how great they are? And you know, and it is true. They are heroic. They're trying to do something that is fairly impossible, as I said. But that doesn't mean it's good. You know, maybe the other side, the fact that it is so difficult, it ought to be an indication to us that it really isn't natural, that it is not planned that the wife, the mother, would have no support whatsoever from the husband and do it all herself. Or even if the support is only financial, that's still not enough. You know, Hank, I was just reading an interview in the Wall Street Journal magazine with Ben Affleck, the actor, and I was surprised that in response to one of the questions, he said, a child needs two parents in the home. And they were saying, like, what are your goals? I want to be a good father. It is important that I be a good father to my children. It was surprising. I almost wondered how he got away with that, because you're not supposed to say that anymore. And it sounds like even without a church, even without a faith being part of it, he's just realized that a child really does need two parents. They need the example of female and male, both in the home. They need the strength of the father, the authority of the father, especially as a boy grows up. In single mother homes, too often, when the boy gets to be 13 or 14, 15, he realizes he's bigger and stronger than his mom, and he doesn't have to behave anymore, doesn't have to obey her. And then that's when his life can begin to go very wrong. We need both a mother and a father, and that seems to be the way that God has arranged the human species to be, and that we continue to need each other all the way through the 50 years.
You're talking about Ben Affleck. I remember writing in one of my books about President Barack Obama, I think before he became president, was talking about the exact same thing, how important it was to have gender-differentiated parenting. Men and women bring complementary roles to the process, and you can't do without both roles. And he went into the statistics and so forth, and all of that was before, you know, the woke ideology just overwhelmed him.
Boy, yeah, what a shame. I mean, the truth is really obvious if you think about it even a little bit, and if you think about the examples you've known of various marriages and families, and it just takes a huge amount of willpower to ignore the obvious.
Yeah, that's right. You know, I said I wanted to get back to adoption, Frederica. Why is adoption so disparaged by abortion advocates? Why this war on adoption?
Yeah, the war on adoption. I think for one thing that it is obvious as soon as people think of it that it would be better than abortion. And so they want to put it down for that reason. They want to make it look like it isn't a good option. She still has to have the abortion because adoption just doesn't work. And I learned in the process of studying this, and I was so sad to hear, but sometimes black girls are told they want to adopt your baby because they want a slave, and this child will just grow up to be a servant in the home and serve the parents and the other siblings. It's lies like that that just poison people. The problem with adoption is that usually the woman doesn't want to do it. She doesn't want to give up her child. And there are ways of having an open adoption where both the parents, the adoptive parents, are raising the child and the mother can come for visits from time to time. there are ways of preserving that if that's what she's intent on. But the reason the pro-choicers have to disparage it so much is, I think, exactly that, that it looks like there are alternatives to abortion, life-affirming alternatives to abortion, and I think they have a hard time with that.
When you wrote your book, and I don't know if things have changed, but you pointed out that there's official resistance to allowing black babies to be placed in white families, and that for many, many years, the National Association of Black Social Workers insisted that black children should be placed only with black families.
Yes, that's so difficult. And once again, it's not looking at what's best for the child. It's thinking that somehow the child is going to be mistreated in the home or couldn't be understood, or you know, the mother won't know how to do her daughter's hair or things like that. It's very insulting and very racist to look at it that way.
It is racist. I mean, that's the bottom line.
Yes, yes. And, well, I'm so sorry to see the way our country is changing. I think we had accomplished an extraordinary thing in being able to reverse racism to the extent that we have. I grew up in Charleston, South Carolina in the 1960s. I remember what it was like. I love old movies. I see black people in movies from the 30s or 40s having roles that are demeaning and insulting, and they're there to laugh at. With all that whites in our country have done to harm and heartbreak black people, boy, we were reaching such a great denouement. We were approaching something like the kind of race blindedness that we need to have a truly successful America. And I'm just so regretful that that's being pulled to pieces now.
I hate to ask you to do this, but you do it in your book, and I do think it's important to discuss the very difficult issue of abortion procedure. What actually happens? I mean, so often you have this picture of a little blob in a uterus and we just get rid of that. But the actual procedure is draconian when you think about what's actually happening in the various D and C, D and E, D and X, and so forth. I think we need to discuss that, as difficult as it is.
As difficult as it is. And of course, the procedure that we've heard a lot about and seen illustrated is what pro-lifers call the partial birth abortion, where the baby is born feet first up to the head, and then the head is punctured and the brain sucked out. It's so horrifying. It's such a dreadful thing. And the alternative, the reason why they invented this partial birth abortion was that the way they did it earlier was the doctor would reach into the womb with something like a pair of tongs and tear the limbs off the baby one after another, pulling out an arm, pulling out another arm, pulling out a leg, until he'd gotten all the pieces out, and then crushing the skull so it could be pulled out as well. As horrible as that is, there was danger that the inside of the uterus might be scratched by the bones or by the tongs. So this, quote, partial birth method was supposed to be the answer. It'll make everything all right. The toll on doctors must be horrible. I hear every once in a while about abortion doctors and the nightmares they suffer and the horrible feelings they have about themselves. It's either that, if they have a grain of humanity left, or they become depraved in some way, like that awful doctor in Philadelphia who kept all his souvenirs in little bottles on the shelf. But that is the most extreme. That kind of abortion takes place only in the second half of pregnancy, or even the third trimester. The earlier way is not better. So if you have an early abortion at 6, 7, 8, 12 weeks, this is done by vacuuming the baby out of the womb. So the doctor has an implement with a very powerful vacuum force. I read somewhere it's 40 times the strength of a household vacuum cleaner. And the tube, of course, has to be smaller than the baby so that it will attach to the baby and suck it into the tube. And the doctor just keeps vacuuming, blindly vacuuming the inside of the uterus until all the pieces have flowed through the clear tube, and he can see that he's gotten everything. If he doesn't get it all, it will cause an infection and possibly a very dangerous infection for the mother. So he's careful to vacuum it all out. That's not better, you know? That's still pretty horrifying. But the curtains are usually drawn around that procedure so people don't know how it's done. There is no good way to do this. It's an unnatural act in every respect. And so there's never going to be any humane way to kill a baby. It's always going to be hideous.
The point you just made with respect to the vacuum and the power of that suction, the imprint on a woman can be such that if later on in life she even hears the sound of a vacuum cleaner, it will be destructive to her.
Yes, yes, that's so true. This can be so nightmarish to her for the rest of her life. And many of the women I interviewed who had had an abortion and then later had children talked about how the process of going through labor and birthing the baby, she just felt like such a hypocrite. She felt like she wasn't worthy of being a mother. She thought that she ought to die in the process of birth. The self-hatred women can develop after an abortion can affect them during later pregnancies, later childbirth processes. When they hear a vacuum cleaner, there's so many ways that it can be triggered. There was an ad some years ago, a commercial on TV, that ended up with the words, "They promised you that you wouldn't have to hear a baby crying in the night," but they were wrong. Because women, they hear those cries and recall that even years after an abortion. It haunts them.
Yeah, haunting. You know, I suppose that leads me into a question about the abortion industry in general. Is this just a crass money-making business?
I'm afraid that it is. I don't have firsthand knowledge about that. It would seem that it must be because doctors have to be completely aware of what they're doing. Nurses have to be completely aware of what they're doing. It's not something that somebody hands them the vacuum tube and tells them what to do, and they don't understand the process or what they're up to at that moment. In order to numb the conscience so that that can be treated as something normal, I do wonder if there are people who just absolutely have no conscience, have lost the shreds of humanity. On the other hand, there has been a steady stream of people leaving the abortion industry, that they come to a point where it's just too much, where they can't avoid anymore. Knowing what they always have known, it becomes too insistent within them. And, of course, Abby Johnson at the Planned Parenthood in Texas wrote a whole book about it, and she has a project called, I think the name of it is something like Not One Left, but it's her business to talk to abortion providers and examine with them the feelings of ambivalence and horror inside, the frequency of nightmares, and help them decide they don't want to and they don't have to continue in that line of work.
What does it mean to be a victim of unisex sexuality?
To be a victim of unisex sexuality, we haven't quite seen that yet, but isn't it? It's the children who are in school right now, and we can't know exactly what it's going to mean. One thing that I think, though, I think it will mean rebellion, and because everybody listening to this should think back to what it was like to go through puberty and how insistent the desire for the opposite sex is for most of us, and how that's so ungovernable and unanswerable. It's such a vehemently powerful force inside human beings to make us want to mate so that we can breed. You know, it's just that simple if you think of humans as mammals. So if you try to teach children that really there's only one sex and it's all just decoration and what you choose to do with it, they may believe that fantasy when they're 5 or 8 or 12 years old, but by the time they're in their teens, everything in their body will be telling them the opposite, that there's something so delightful and so attractive that you just crave the opposite sex and you're glad they're opposite. Vive la différence, as the French used to say.
I think something else that was striking in your book, Frederica, was talking about women wanting what men want. So if a man wants it, the woman must want it as well. And then you say, want what? Well, office politics and martini lunches and ulcers and early heart attacks. And you say, you know, I guess this has been a wonderland that women have been excluded from too long, and that in some sense, a paycheck is more fulfilling than an orgasm.
Yes, yes. That's one of the things I have in my book, that, yeah, you just transmute entirely into a male persona, and then you can get ahead in the business world. Back in the earlier years of feminism, women wore suits. You know, they wore little pinstripe suits with skirts and bow tie instead of a man's tie. But it was so evident that we were trying to ape what men had, as if that was something that was so desirable, as if it was the only real life. And we didn't realize how truly anti-feminist that is, to be trying to, you know, exclude and shove to the side everything that women have always loved and enjoyed, the world of being home with your child and raising your child and providing. That's something that we had to sneer at. And the world that men had of their corner offices and so forth, somehow that was so desirable. It's like the opposite of feminism, you know? We had those paradoxes. And part of it also has to do with sexual desire and women being taught to think that they want to have a lot of uncommitted relationships. I think women don't really want that. That's not naturally what women want. We want that commitment. We want to be adored, you know. I have marveled over the years of my 15 grandchildren. Why is it that the girls want to be princesses? They want to be told how beautiful they are. They want to be decorated. All the Disney princess movies are about that. But the boys want to have adventures. They want to go out. They team up with other boys. They're not separated, one alone, this perfect princess. I think it has something to do with preparing hearts for what it will be like when it's time to have children, to nurture and care for them, and to boldly go out and do and achieve whatever's necessary to make a home for your wife and your child. It's a beautiful thing, and they'll never be able to stamp it out, but they sure can try.
There are so many wonderful aspects of your book. One of the things you talk about is the stupidity of not raising your own children, how a woman goes to work, and by the time she figures out what she pays for child care and for having someone else raise her child, she ends up discovering that there's not a lot of financial or psychological benefit that she has achieved from all of this. And in the process, someone else has actually had that benefit, and you were deprived of it.
It's so true. And what have you achieved except adding a lot of stress to your life? So it kind of backfires for women to put their children in daycare and then pursue a career. Not in every case. And especially it's more possible when we can work from home. I love to see dads work from home. My son David, the one with the 9 children, works from home. His wife does the homeschooling. They all work together. And being available like that, that's the human tradition. You know, you have your shop below your home, you know, you have an apartment up above the shop, or if you're a carpenter, your home is in the back, you're right there. So, yeah, this desire for what men supposedly have is not true, and it just backfires on women. The desire, that instinctive desire to have separate roles for boys and girls, for men and women, is such a deep part of our biology and our hormones. It can't be eradicated. I remember my little grandchildren, cousins, were playing once, and I asked, you know, oh, what are you guys playing? They had some little vehicles they were rolling back and forth. And the girl said, we're playing going to a wedding. And the boy said, we're playing riding in a truck. Can't eradicate it.
Why did you address in your book the issue of government welfare programs?
Oh, yes. You know, I came to the conclusion that this is something pregnancy care centers really emphasized, was we can help you make your way so that you qualify for welfare. They would be helping women fill out the forms and taking them to the office and putting it where it needed to be and encouraging them along every step of the way. From one perspective, you really see the need for that, because this is a way the woman can have food and can have lodging and all the things she needs in order to continue her life and raise her child. And on the other hand, I see that there's, somebody said you get more of what you subsidize and less of what you tax. And if we subsidize and encourage ways for women to get along without men, men are going to seize that opportunity. They'll be in favor of that. But it undermines the family. And I think the long-term damage is pretty bad. So it's a shame that's something that pro-life centers fall into automatically, as well as often demonizing the father of the child. You know, they see a lot of bad guys, but they tend to see marriage as impossible because the guys are all irresponsible and they're no good and you probably have other girlfriends and so forth. I think we need to find a way to encourage marriage and encourage marriage to the worthy guys who are worth it and move away from encouraging welfare. We're in the middle of this situation where welfare is so essential, but I think the long-term damage is not small. It's pretty serious.
What were you driving at in the book when you made the comment that Mexican-American women that are born in Mexico have healthier babies than Mexican-American women who are born in the United States?
Yes, that was a startling but I think very significant statistic when I read it. It's that Mexican-American women who are in labor, you know, we'll envision it that way, if they give birth in Mexico, their health outcome and the outcome for the baby is better than if they give birth in America. And the reason is they don't have the same support system. Mm. They don't have, in America, where we just, you know, smash families and separate everybody into a separate economic unit, they don't have the traditional forms of support from the women in the neighborhood and in your village and your mother and your aunt and everybody else is there to help you and encourage you and help you know how to do things. What do you do now that you've got this baby? That's something that people can have in a more committed society where people are really interconnected with each other. But in America, we all tend to get atomized and it's not available. It's merely medical, you know, it's merely institutional care that they get. And that's not the same as somebody who knows you and loves you, helping you to make decisions, helping you along the way.
I want you to talk about the structure of your book for a moment, because every other chapter is a listening chapter. You're listening to women in Washington, D.C. or Spokane, Washington, or wherever. You're listening to their stories. And you, I think, are trying to point out that post-abortion women have the responsibility to reach out and let other women know what, not just women, but men as well, what's on the other side of an abortion. There are dramatic consequences.
There really are. And I think about what the difference it would be if post-abortion women were given the spotlight from time to time and given a chance to talk about how it affected them in the long run. Not the ones who are being told to shout your abortion and to be proud of it and to, you know, to celebrate the fact that you had an abortion. We need to hear from the ones who found it heartbreaking. I remember one of the women in my book hated herself so much that for subsequent abortions, she said she wanted to go to the dirtiest clinic that she could find, and she refused to have any painkillers. And she just felt like she should suffer for the fact of what she'd done and was doing again by having a subsequent abortion. Boy, there's stories that need to be told. And so when I set up the book, I alternated with one chapter on something like adoption or welfare, and then the next chapter would be going to one of these cities and being in a group of post-abortion women, and I would just say, tell me your story. How did you come to make the decision to have an abortion? What led up to that? And they are such beautiful and such heartbreaking stories. Yeah, sometimes very encouraging. I remember the woman whose husband, driving to the abortion clinic, she said, I'm not sure this is right. And he said, do you think you're smarter than the Supreme Court? So he was so harsh. She had the abortion. 2 weeks later, a friend told him about what an abortion procedure is. and he became vehemently pro-life, and then he was protesting outside, like right away he was protesting outside the abortion clinic. Boy, there's some amazing stories in there. There's stories that need to be told. And in fact, I was thinking the other day that a friend of mine who's a professor of the history of journalism said, it's those chapters that will continue to have value. He said, your chapters where you're doing statistics and analyzing and recommending policy and all that, that's so dated. And of course, it's very dated today. But he said, historians so seldom get to hear firsthand reports from people involved in something. What you hear is the chronicler writes down what the king said. You know, it's the important guy in the official recorder. But the unvarnished voices of women speaking for themselves, he said that's the thing that will have continuing value for people forever, and especially for historians trying to understand how this happened. So I think, Hank, I'm actually going to turn this into a smaller, slimmer book that I will call Real Voices. And I will just put in it these chapters where the women are speaking about their own experience. Perhaps does have more lasting, long-term value than my ideas of what we should be doing.
No, I think the whole book as it is fantastic, but I do think that this new idea for the book is also very, very worthwhile. What was it like for you? I mean, just as a woman, as an interviewer, as an intellectual, what was it like for you to get involved in listening to these stories? How did that impact your life?
Oh, boy. Of course, I didn't know what I was going to find. I had met women who'd had abortions and talked to them from time to time, just a few of them. And I couldn't imagine, for one thing, how will women act toward one another? Will they be shy and afraid to say very much? What about ones who were vehemently pro-choice before the abortion, and those who were vehemently pro-life but couldn't bear that mom and dad would find out, so she had an abortion? I was a little bit nervous because I didn't know what to expect. But I came, this is the old days, with just a cassette tape recorder, and I would set it up and just get them, you know, the first one starts talking, and then it was very easy after that. I was glad to see that women did relax and share, perhaps in the way that women do when it's just women there, and did not seem to be intimidated by me or my recorder at all, thank God. I was so moved by what I heard. Sometimes I was angered at the way a woman had been treated. Sometimes I had tears come to my eyes when I heard a story. It was a deeply bonding sort of experience to relive those memories all together and to support each other. It was actually quite a beautiful experience, and I feel so blessed at all the things that I learned during that process.
Yeah, and this is a beautiful book, and I want to say to everyone listening in to this podcast, this book is available for those of you who stand shoulder to shoulder with us in the battle for life and truth, and in this case, we're talking about life in a sense of the foundation of civilization. The book is available on the web at equip.org. You can also write me at Post Office Box 8500, Charlotte, North Carolina, zip code 28271. I am very fascinated by something you sent me. I had some of these quotes myself in various writings that I've done over the years, but you sent me something just before the podcast. And it goes back to when the church was young. And I think what's so striking in reading what you sent me, one page, I think that page is just so valuable. You go back to the Didache, something that might even be traced to a time before the fall of the temple in AD 70. The letter of Barnabas, Felix, Tertullian, St. John Chrysostom, St. Basil, all these great men who are part and parcel of the church talking about abortion in the early centuries. And they were talking about potions that kill a child. They were talking about the instruments that kill. I mean, this is powerful. So it underscores the fact that this problem that we're talking about in the 21st century was a problem the church was dealing with and dealing with adequately when the church was young.
That is so true. And it's surprising, isn't it? This was one of the reasons that women wanted to become Christians, was that the Christians do not kill newborn babies. They don't perform abortions. They welcome life. You know, the situation in the Roman Empire was ghastly that the father was the supreme authority if a new baby was born, and he would go and he would look at it. And if he didn't want the baby, he would simply walk away. If he wanted the baby, he would pick it up, and that was the sign the baby was now part of the household. But, you know, maybe he already had a few daughters. This is another girl. He doesn't want it. So what would happen is the baby would be perhaps strangled, maybe smothered. In many cases, they would just put them outside. They would just, you know, go to a corner in the city and just deposit the crying baby there. And sometimes people would take the child home and raise it and love it. Sometimes they would take the child home and raise it and then use it for sexual trafficking or sell it as a slave. There are a lot of different motivations people have for taking hold of a baby that's lying there free. But, of course, very often no person got to the baby before dogs did, and the dogs or other animals would tear it apart. This was standard in the Roman Empire. And when women began to hear that Christians opposed that, it made them flock to the church because their hearts were broken by the babies they'd lost. And the idea that they respected the childbearing capacity of women and the babies themselves, that was all by itself. The fact that the church stood for sexual morality, for fidelity within marriage, those are the very things that drew women to the church. And as you say, these quotations, I think I've got about 8 of them right here from various early church documents. And I mean early, like from 70 or 80 AD, as you say, the same time the Gospels were being written, some of them. They're very straightforward. Now, what some people say is, oh, they said that because the mother might die. They weren't concerned about the baby at all. It was just whether the mother died. But no, if you read this, it's explicit. It's saying you will not kill a little one. This is not all right. You will not kill a child. So, as I said, that was one of the main things that attracted women to the church, was this opposition to exposure of infants, killing, infanticide, killing of newborns, and abortion, various forms of abortion before the birth.
You know, it's interesting, as you were talking, I was thinking back to an experience that I had. What triggered that in my mind was when you said they were flocking to the churches because of the position that the church had, the respect for life and so forth. I remember speaking in, or at least I was about to speak in a large mega church. I was sitting in the green room and the pastor came in and asked me, Hank, what are you going to speak on this time? And I said, you know, I'm going to talk about the issue of abortion. I just developed an abortion acronym and that was going to be the essence of my message. And he said, please, Hank, don't talk about that.
Oh.
And his reason for that was he didn't want to hurt the women who had had abortions. He said, so many of the women in the church have had abortions. And if you talk about abortion, it will hurt them. What's an appropriate response to that?
Boy, what you say really resonates with me. And I'm the wife of a pastor, so that's an aspect of it. When I used to be part of a group that met once a quarter that was the leadership, the presidents and leaders of all the national pro-life organizations, and something that we would often talk about is, why don't the pastors support us? There are Christians out there that are pro-life, and if we could only reach them and bring them together, but the bottleneck is the pastor. He doesn't want to talk about it for exactly this reason. I'm afraid someone in the congregation will begin to cry. That was the vivid image in the heart and the minds of many of these pastors. They felt that it wasn't, as that pastor told you, that it wasn't right to hurt a woman in this way. I remember one of the pro-life leaders saying, maybe she needs to cry. You know, maybe that will be the beginning of her healing. And that's very true. And thank God there are so many resources and organizations for post-abortion women. Just about any pregnancy care center you can go to, there will be women there who have had abortion, who understand what you went through, and who are trained, who know how to help you get past the tears and assimilate the truth of what has happened, accept it, and know that God is caring for that child and keeping that child until you join that child when you return to the presence of God. there's much good news and much comfort to be had. It's very important that women bear their responsibility. They did find that if they took the tack of blaming the man or blaming society or something, the women didn't actually get healed. That accepting what you did and recognizing what it really was is an important key to healing.
Beautifully said. Yeah, I want to close this podcast with some rapid-fire questions. I sort of have you respond to claims from both sides, the pro-life and the pro-choice side. The first statement that's made is women and women alone have the right to decide what to do with their bodies. How would you respond to that?
Yes, yes, the woman alone has the right to decide. So I would grant a woman the right to decide about her own body, but not somebody else's body, which is what the unborn child is. The unborn child in the woman's womb has the right to keep her arms and legs connected to her body. She has the right to remain intact, to remain alive. So, yeah, it's not only your body we're talking about.
Wow, well said. Access to legal, professionally performed abortions reduces maternal injury and reduces death that would be caused by an unsafe, illegal abortion.
Mm-hmm. Yes,
you know, the coat hanger.
right, the coat hanger image. When they asked in Louisiana, this was decades ago, but they were considering a restrictive abortion law, and they asked, if you got pregnant, would you have an illegal abortion? And 98% of the respondents said, heck no, those are dangerous. You know, if it's one thing that pro-life and pro-choice agree on, it's that illegal abortion is dangerous, so you shouldn't do it. Both sides have emphasized this message. Pro-lifers are just as opposed to illegal abortion as they are to legal abortion. So I feel like, you know, this is one thing that both sides agree on, so let's get together and keep saying how bad illegal abortion is. We can totally agree on that. But there is one more thing about that. Coincidentally, right about the time that abortion became legal, they invented this vacuum suction device. And it is used not only for abortions, but it's done in cases where the interior of the uterus just needs to be vacuumed out. For example, if there's a miscarriage, but the child has not come out of the body, so they might go in with this vacuum device. And an extremely pro-life doctor said, it is so much better compared to what I had before, which was basically using a scalpel, using a knife and going in and trying to cut everything. Of course, you could injure the womb. Now that these suction devices, which are so safe, they exist everywhere, it seems likely that if illegal abortion continues, it will be by the use of these machines, which are not going to be destroyed, which still have legitimate uses. So the specter of the coat hanger is no longer an accurate one. These vacuum suction machines are going to be there, so it's not going to be that dangerous if there is illegal abortion. But, of course, we pro-lifers vehemently oppose illegal abortion.
Why should someone who doesn't believe in God, who doesn't have any religious belief, be forced to adhere to a moral argument that is against abortion and just doesn't apply to their personal beliefs?
Yes. You know, people almost never use religious arguments to oppose abortion. It's not a religious issue. It's a human rights issue. And the child has the right to remain alive just as much as a tortured prisoner has the right to be freed, just as much as anyone who's injured at work has the right to good medical care so they don't get infected and get sicker and sicker. So all of these reasons are secular reasons why abortion is wrong. It's an act of violence. That's the main thing. You don't have to believe in God to know that that's wrong.
Abortion, though, Frederica, gives pregnant women the option to choose not to bring fetuses that might have profound abnormalities to full term.
Yes, yeah. You know, once again, there are couples who would love to adopt a child who has abnormalities, even if it wasn't going to live very long. They just have more love to spare, and they would love to give that to a child, even a dying child. So that's not a good excuse. But I remember, I want to give a little illustration of a friend of mine who was pregnant with twins, and they found out during the pregnancy that the child was extremely deformed. that her skull had not sealed and the brains were separate from her head, hanging off the back of her head, she would not be able to survive. It was, you know, perhaps if she could breathe, maybe for a few hours, but death was inevitable. So they tried to get the woman to agree to have that baby aborted and let the other baby continue to live. And of course she disagreed. When the baby was born, the parents and the grandparents were called in and they wrapped the baby in a blanket, and this little girl with a terrible, mortal situation that she could never survive, she was loved. She was wrapped in blankets and placed in her mother's arms, and she was kissed and passed from hand to hand, and the grandmother was singing lullabies from the old country, and this child had a beautiful death. Mm. And this child died knowing that it was loved. It wasn't cut to pieces. That's the difference.
Yeah, and, you know, as you're talking about that, Frederica, I was thinking about my dad. He was dying of a fibrosis in the lungs, and so it encroached upon his ability to take in oxygen and slowly suffocating to death, and a very, very difficult death. And I remember asking my dad while he was going through this process, wouldn't you just like to just die and go home and be with the Lord? And he looked at me and he said, Hank, every moment is precious. And what you just communicated, and by the way, you know, on his deathbed, before he died, he was able to pray a blessing over every one of his children, grandchildren, and great-grandchildren. We were able to assemble everybody there, and it was the quintessential example of what he was saying, every moment is precious. But you're now pointing out that this is true on both sides of the spectrum, at the end of life, but also in this case, as you so beautifully communicated, at the beginning of life.
That we can be welcomed into the world and held in loving arms, that should be the birthright of every child. And if the child is dying, then love her more. She needs your love more than ever.
What about contraception? Should it be free and easily available to everyone?
I think contraception hasn't helped, that it actually has caused more uncommitted sex or enabled more uncommitted sex. And there's been social and community cultural problems as a result of that. But I wouldn't, that is an issue that some people object to on religious grounds. And if they're not religious, they see that it doesn't really hurt anyone. And so I don't think it should be forbidden, except for methods that actually cause abortions, that cause early abortions, instead of preventing pregnancy. In our Orthodox Church, there is much in the fathers opposing any form of contraception and indeed expecting that people will only have sex when they're ready to conceive and that you will go through, as St. Paul says in Corinthians, about you separate from each other for a period of time and then come together again. That stuff, that material that doesn't really make sense to people today. So I don't object to contraception as long as it's not a form of abortion. I think that it should remain available to anyone who wants to make use of it. But I think in the long run, it's caused more damage than we ever anticipated.
You know, I have a bunch of other questions to ask you, but I think I'm going to withhold those questions for this podcast. I want to say that your book is an important book, and I really hope that it goes through a new permutations. The book is available now. I've read this book, and I was thinking as I was reading this book, my daughter Christina is involved in a project. I'm also involved in this project of building a St. Hermione home for unwed mothers. And I was thinking about how important it is for someone doing that to read your book. And I know this is asking you to be self-congratulatory, and that's not what I'm trying to do. I do want you to promote the book, though, not because of any crass material reason, but this is a book that can really help people. I have been talking about this issue for 40 years, and I read this book, and there were so many great insights that I gained from reading the book that I thought, man, in fact, David and I were talking about this podcast and saying, you know, this is a book that people that are instrumental in the movement need to read. Can you just close the podcast by saying why? And again, I know this is putting you in a difficult situation because you're promoting something that you wrote, but I think it's important.
I'm very blessed to see the result of the book. Once it came out, there was so much gratitude for it. There were so many people who told me that it brought everything together and gave them some eloquence in speaking to those who are in favor of abortion in a way that was beautiful. It was like clockwork. It's like all the pieces are there and they fit exactly right. It's everything you need. And as a matter of fact, for many years, Real Choices was used in the training of people who worked in pregnancy care centers. It was required reading for volunteers and counselors who wanted to work in a pregnancy center. So all of that makes me feel humbled and awed that God would use me in order to write something that is so useful. You know, I think as a writer, it might sound strange, but that's the most important thing to me. I want to help things happen. I want to help pro-lifers know how to make the best of the situation and encourage them and give them the tools they need to go forward. The biggest thing I want for my work is that it would be useful. And I came to understand that Real Choices was, in fact, a very useful book. So I'm grateful to God for that.
I've said this to you before, but you are an extraordinary writer, just a gifted writer. And Real Choices is a good example of that. The subtitle, Listening to Women, Looking for Alternatives to Abortion. Again, this book available for those who stand shoulder to shoulder with us in the battle for life and truth. You can get your copy on the web at equip.org. Frederica, as always, I am so grateful for your wisdom and for, as I just mentioned, your writing, your friendship, the impact you've made on my family, and the time that you've spent with our listeners on the Hank Unplugged podcast.
I am too, Hank. It's been a delight to meet you and get to know your family, and I'm just so impressed with all of them. It's a wonderful bunch of people. So I hope I can get down to Charlotte more often and spend some time with you guys.
I'll definitely take you out to eat again.
I would welcome that.
And you can stay at our house anytime you want.
So sweet.
Yeah, it was so fun. I think back to the impact you had, even on my brother, when he had so many questions about orthodoxy. And I remember you sitting on our back porch talking to the kids and to my brother. And now he's a catechumen.
Oh, thanks be to God. I'm so glad.
Yeah.
I thought, oh, he's got some good questions. I don't know if I'm ready for this. But The Lord is working in his heart. So thanks be to God. I'm glad to hear it.
Well, thanks for all of you who tuned in to this Hank Unplugged podcast. Let other people know about the podcast. It is making a difference in the lives of people, not just in the United States, but around the world. Thanks again for tuning in. Look forward to seeing you on the next Hank Unplugged. So long for now.